During your time as president of Foodry, though, when the Mobil Oil lawsuit, there were patent infringement suits with Mobil at that time. Were you involved in that?
Yes. In fact, I settled it for $3 million cash. I remember going over to the Mobil lawyer and it was right at Christmas time. And going over to his office and getting handed this $3 million check. And I said, "Now I'm going to get this in the bank right now." And he said, "It would be better." And so I had the controller of the company, of the Hoodry company, with me. He and I went over to the bank and handed him the $3 million. These were expenses that I wasn't prepared for. You try to do the best you know how, but really, if you have time to think about the experience after you've done it, you know that there's a lot of better ways. But that lawsuit was, I worked out the agreement and settlement with one of the senior vice presidents of Mobil. And he and I would meet at the University Club there in New York, where it was new and nobody knew that we were meeting, and that was the last thing. We didn't want anybody to know that we were meeting because it was a settlement of a big lawsuit. George?
Well, as a result of that settlement, then, because as I understand it, Mobil had been an early partner in the whole process.
Yes, of course, they owned the Hoodry. And they had the team set up so that it was a Hoodry Project Corporation, and Mobil had 40% of the stock.
But in the settlement, then, were they free to go ahead and use any of the processes?
No, they weren't.
They were,
but they did anyway.
Okay.
And that was how we put the bill on them in the patent lawsuit, and so. We had a pretty good idea how much money they had made on it, and they made about $3 million, and then we got the $3 million, and they got out of the field entirely and left the field open to Hoodry, which is all that the French people had gotten.
At the same time, that period, 52 to 56, you were director of the Catalytic Construction Company.
Yeah, and that was earlier. A wholly owned subsidiary of Hoodry. That started out to be a part of Sun Oil Company. Art Pugh set that up before he left the Sun Oil Company. And it was a part of Sun Oil. It could be very dangerous on that account from a standpoint of law, and it was a liability that the Sun Oil stockholders, and when you talk to the Sun Oil stockholders, the Pugh family didn't want to take. And Art Pugh had gone ahead with the setting it up as he saw fit without properly talking it over with the rest of the family. And after they looked into it, from all the angles, legal angles, they did not want to jeopardize the whole company being involved in an engineering construction business. there was a lot of money in that, but it didn't match the money that the oil company was making with their production, crude oil production, with all the other things they had. So Art wasn't there at that time, but I'm sure he agreed that these liabilities were too big.
You indicated that you made a few comments about your move to Sun, which happened in 1956.
I was dead before I became 50 years old. Mm. 1 month before.
And your title was Executive Director of Commercial Development.
Well, that was part of it. It was an Executive Director of Research and Development at the time, but I created the Commercial Development Department there as part of my job, because we started working on the commercialization of polypropylene. And we didn't know how really to go into the polypropylene business. And I had the job of setting up a team of people that we found out how to do it. And it was successful, highly successful. It was so successful that some law company sold the polypropylene business to Amoco, Standard Oil of Indiana, for $87 million. Now that was a lot more money than we could have. Hoogie came out of that very well.
This was Avison, was that the name of the
Avison
company?
Avison was the corporation, and we sold Avison to Chemical Company. So they made more money the first year they had that company. John Sullivan told me this, and I know he's been misrepresented. He said, we made more money than that than we paid for the company.
In the first year.
And Dunlop and his crew, they figured this out, and they thought, oh boy, they'd really come out with a great deal. Well, of course, you've got to recognize that there was a hell of a lot of strength in this earnings that they had the first year from the Amoco Chemical Company itself. They weren't a bunch of dumbbells. They were pretty smart people.
You're quoted as saying, "Wound to Sun," and I'm quoting now, "My most difficult changeover was going from technical work to administrative. The hardest lesson..."
Well, it really, my hardest lesson there was Sun Oil was an old company compared with Hoover. And there was a lot of people in the wings that thought they should have had the job I was given. And it was just like my leaving the Hoodry Process Corporation and selecting the guy that took my place. Well, it was people in the Hoodry Process Corporation that thought they should have had that job rather than Ted Burtis. Well, they put all these other limitations on me. That in the first place, they wanted to make sure that they were looking eventually that this man might head up Sun Oil. As it turned out, that was damn, they were lucky that they had him. They were lucky. Because Dunlop made he and Jay Howard made a very bad mistake in putting Bob Charbaugh in that spot. Because Charbaugh was not as pliable a man as Burtis was. And Burris, he ran away with the job. He was just temperamentally and professionally finished. He was a perfect fit for the job. Couldn't have had a better one.
You and Charles Thomas.
Charlie Thomas, he was a great guy.
Had a patent which I was intrigued by, involving rocket fuel containing polyolefin and boron. Now, I know boron compounds are used in rocket fuel, but I was intrigued by the polyolefin aspect of it. How you got involved in rocket fuels.
Well, that was a paper patent.
Okay.
And we thought about it, and he thought about it, and what our thoughts, we put them together, and that's how the patent came to be. But Charlie, I have a book that he wrote, and give me, I think I can get that book. Detract from what you want. That's all I'm supposed to say. Here it is.
What is the title of that book?
Catalytic Processes and Proven Catalysts. In fact, it's one of the best books I've seen, particularly if you're out in the field practicing.
This was published back in 1970.
Yeah, that's pretty close to the time I retired. I remember going in and telling J.R. that I decided to take early retirement. See, they had a system there that they were going to retire me anyway in a couple of years, maybe 3 years. It was. And, but I could retire at that time and go into consulting, which I did. And well, I probably would have done better if I had stayed with them, but I didn't.
One of the things that you were involved with when you were Vice President's son, I think you just changed the title from Executive Director to Vice President for R&D, essentially. Is that correct?
That's correct. Well, actually, the Peel family had never had anybody that came into their company that they advanced as rapidly. they looked back on them themselves. Like J. Howard Peel, he worked a hell of a long time before he got, and then there were other people in the company too that he worked a long time as the controller of the company before, well, they made him president because Art Pugh told him he wasn't going to let them shape his life. So they said, okay, then we're going to make some changes. And after they got through making the changes, he decided to leave. But I think it was bad. I think that's another one that I've looked at carefully, and I think that very bad mistakes were made. They let a genius leave. Art Pugh was a genius. And there was bad blood, and there was bad feelings among Uncle Joe and Art. See, Art Pugh's father was an alcoholic, and he died as an alcoholic. And he didn't, he wouldn't listen to them when they were trying to get him to stop drinking. And that's what he had to do, but they went about it wrong, I think.
You were involved in the, in some respects, in the Puerto Rico project.
Oh, yeah. In fact,
you were head of the task force, I guess, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Can you tell me something about the Puerto Rico project and what that was all about?
Well, it started out that it was created because of laws here in this country that had made great concessions to industry set up in Puerto Rico. And actually, we could manufacture lubricating oil down there rather than Marcus Hook, and we could make a killing on it. And it just turned out that, well, that was a better way to do it. We could import it into this country without any import duty or anything. So the company was set up down there, and it was set up primarily to manufacture lubricating oil. And it had been very, very successful.
It was also at this time that you called attention to Dunlop, called Dunlop's attention to a talk by Stuart Udall about the environment. He started then, this was 1967, warning the company that they were going to have to do something about their relationship with the environment.
Yes, I thought they were going to have to stop marketing leaded fuel. Actually, Sun didn't market on leaded fuel until after World War II. And the reason they did got into leaded fuel then was because the country was divided up, various refiners, and put in, and they were stacked together. But I could see that they were going to have, all the refining was going to have to get out of the lead, because by guys, the lead, it was poison. We knew it was poison. We didn't have to run any tests on that. And frankly, we're now just finding out, just recently, finding out how terrible poisoning it was, because from any throughway, any place where there was heavy traffic, the lead that was deposited out on the ground around that throughway was saturated with lead. Many schools. They were near the throughway. These kids in the school were being poisoned of lead. And it's still going on, even to this day. And the son was glad that I did that. And Dunlop was president of the American API, American Petroleum Institute. And I had a program that would help all of the members of the API, and this program was put together, and I didn't want to be a part of it. I was getting out. I was leaving Sun. And there was a friend of mine at a Texas company. He came to me and said, "Look, our company feels that you are the one that should handle it." Well, okay. I finally decided I would, because I felt so keenly about the environmental impact of it. And so I did. And fortunately, I had Dunlop as president of the Institute. And I could get my program put through pretty quickly. In fact, I gave a speech there in the Chicago meeting, the annual meeting of the Institute, and lay out the program and told them how much it was going to cost. And it was all cut and dried. One guy from the Standard Oil Company in New Jersey got up and moved and took it. And one, I think, from Shell got up and seconded the motion. And they unanimous. They approved it. They all, this thing was clear. It was screaming at us. You're going to have to stop this. And these are the sort of things, even now today, our nation is doing, and we're going to have to change. We're going to have to change. I may not be around when the change takes place, although I do think I'm going to be around another 10 or 15 years. There's some radical changes in ethics and morals are at the bottom of it. That's why I put that on my program as probably the most important area. That will occupy our attention in the future. I think it will.
Just before you left Sun, you were involved in the late 60s in oceanography.
Yeah, I still work with some of those people.
I'm curious how you got involved in ocean work, as it were. You were on Nixon's task force in oceanography, and
yeah,
you received an award from the Navy. How did you get involved in that aspect?
Well, Sun Oil Company joined an organization that was had a subcommittee on site. Ocean Science and Technology Advisory Committee. And I was chairman of that committee. And one of the things I said was that I contacted I knew all the presidents of the big oil companies, my first name, and they respected me, and I respected them. And I contacted them and told them that okay, there's going to be a movement take place with regard to the handling of crude oil and all crude oil products. And unless the oil companies go into this and get on this Ocean Science and Technology Advisory Committee, put three people on there to shape the future of this. You're going to get it rammed down your throat by the government. And I would urge that you go back and think about it very carefully. Well, most of them didn't have to go back and think. They knew damn well what I was telling them was true. They've been around. And one of the key people on that was Amor Lennon, a Jewish boy that lived over here in Washington. And Amor really was an electrical engineer. But he had a lot of experience with the ocean, and I hadn't had any experience. But I did have a lot of experience in the petroleum industry. And I knew the way that things were going. But the oil industry was not going to be able to get by with what they had been doing. They were going further into the ocean to find and produce oil. And this situation, they were going to have to pay more attention to it. They still haven't paid enough. That's how Texaco, that's how Exxon got picked up in Alaska. They didn't give the attention that they should. I knew damn well that the inland up there was hazardous. I knew that. In fact, when I was with IRDA, and I guided studies that we made there, and we knew full well that this is terrible for bringing tankers in, sea-going tankers in, to pick up a million barrels of oil and then go trotting out through that hazardous area. Well, this captain, apparently, I think what he probably did, he got drunk. And he ripped a hole in his tanker.